Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio.
We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location. East of the Appalachian Mountains. Our IQ window forecast is about 72 degrees. Clear outside. The solar wind tonight is almost 400 kilometers per second. And we've got two active sunspot regions that are really playing havoc with us. 1032 and another large complex to the west of that on the sun. Interesting thing is, yesterday, both of them exploded at the same time. When they did, they launched a coronal mass ejection, although it's moving kind of slowly, about 500 kilometers per second, so it could take as much as 4 days to reach us, and it should provide some excellent auroras in the northern latitudes, but so far, we're not thinking that it's going to be anything serious as far as the geomagnetic storm. We're going to get something out of it, but it's not going to be one of those kinds of things to shut down the grid. Still, these two large sunspots are about 65,000 miles in diameter each, and they're pointed at us like a double-barreled shotgun. Well, many people don't think we're undergoing climate change. That just isn't the case. Texas could burn for another 20 years. The state climatologist for Texas says the record drought of 2011 could only be the beginning of a dry spell that could last until 2020. State climatologist John Nielsen Gammon tells the Austin American-Statesman, water planning is often based on standards set by the previous record drought of the 1950s, which lasted nearly 10 years. Nielsen Gammon, who also is a Texas A&M professor of atmospheric sciences, says the present drought could be significantly longer lasting than what has been planned for. They might have to cut down on irrigation from the aquifer. He says that sooner or later there'll be a drought that's worse than the previous standard setter. Forecasters predict dry weather to last long term beyond the next decade, from the La Nina phenomenon returning in 2012 to cool the surface waters of the eastern tropical Pacific Ocean. Also, this just in, forecasters are predicting that the current record high for October of 84.9 degrees will be shattered as the autumn heat wave reaches its peak this weekend. They believe they could even top 86 degrees or higher in some parts of the country. The forecast comes as the country entered its fourth day of an unprecedented Indian summer, which has seen it experience temperatures higher than the Bahamas and Hawaii. Eleanor Crompton, Met Office forecaster, MET Office forecaster, said that there is a good chance of records being broken and temperatures could even get as high as 86 degrees Fahrenheit in London. That is shattering all records for the Mediterranean. We also have a Space Junk Wars update. As if UARS wasn't enough for you to grab your grocery cart and head for the deserts of Southern California looking for space junk, The world was gripped by the NASA UARS satellite that fell back to Earth last Saturday. And now there's another that's plummeting back from orbit. In late October, early November, a Germany astronomy satellite called ROSAT will plunge uncontrolled back to Earth. While slightly smaller than UARS, the German satellite is expected to have more pieces survive re-entry. You know that German engineering can survive almost anything, even re-entry into the atmosphere. The Germany Space Agency estimated that it has a 1 in 2,000 chance of hitting someone. That would definitely ruin your day. And that is actually higher odds than the 1 in 3,200 odds NASA gave for UARS. The German ROSAT satellite was launched in 1990, died in 1998, and weighs 2.5 tons. The German Space Agency estimates that 30 pieces weighing less than 2 tons will survive re-entry. 30 pieces. You might have to take 2 shopping carts out there. Debris may include sharp mirror shards. The German Space Agency put the odds of somebody somewhere on Earth being hurt by its satellite at 1 in 2,000. That's almost Vegas odds. Heiner Klinkrad. Sorry about that. I wanted to say Colonel Klink, but that's not right. Heiner Klinkrad, head of the Space Debris Office at the European Space Agency, said in a webcast posted on the Germany Aerospace Center's website, "It is not possible to accurately predict ROSAT's reentry. The uncertainty will decrease as the moment of reentry approaches. It will not be possible to make any kind of reliable forecast about where the satellite will actually come down until about 1 or 2 hours before the impact." You might have to have that cart a little closer than you think, and you might have to have an engine on it if you're going to get out there in time. Experts believe that the 2 dozen metal pieces from the bus-sized NASA satellite fell over a 500-mile span in the Pacific Ocean. It began hitting the water southwest of Christmas Island. Again, it seems certain that information on where or when the satellite will land is scant. So, get out there, space junk hunters. I'm sure we're in for a very plentiful winter as these things begin to decay and come down. Remember, there's gold in them satellites, and platinum, and rhodium, and palladium, and copper. Your local junk store won't know what to do with all the valuables that you haul in there. I'm just trying to help you. You know, come on. We're trying to create jobs here at X Squared Radio. Now, we have been noticing lately near-Earth objects. I guess everybody has. We had, Comet Elenin, which was the subject of all kinds of great conspiracy theories. It broke up and turned into not much more than a fart and a whirlwind out there 22 million miles from Earth. But it's nevertheless made us aware. It's made us interested. It's we have our asteroid ears on now, and we're listening and watching more for near-Earth objects. And by we, I mean not just the amateurs that are out there taking digital photographs of space day after day or night after night, looking to see if something moved during the night before. That's how most of the amateurs are able to locate all this. But we've had, a couple of asteroids sneak between the moon and Earth just a couple days ago. A NASA space telescope that meticulously mapped the entire sky, I'm sure, has found fewer potentially dangerous asteroids that orbit near Earth. And that's the space agency officials announced 2 days ago. I'm not putting a lot of stock in this. To map the entire sky, as I told you, takes weeks, sometimes months, because what you have to do is put a digital scope geosynchronously locked onto one single star so it does not move. And then you take a series of 1,000 or 10,000 digital images and overlay them one over the other, and so forth. And what you'll end up with, if something is moving, you'll end up with a streak. That is to say, if it's moving against the stationary star field, those will be planets and those will be asteroids. Night after night, you can compare these. You have software that can compare the images, and what you'll find are the very, very distant things that are moving, like comets. They're not very well lit up when they're way, way out there, 100 million miles. But as they get closer in, they begin to reflect the sun's light, and they layer. And what you will end up with is sort of a dotted line across the sky. And that's what these astronomers look for. So it's impossible to do that to the whole sky. And it's impossible to do that with a NASA space telescope. Not possible. It takes thousands of telescopes all around the world looking at different sectors of the sky. So when we see an article come out like this, our BS detector goes off here at X Squared Radio, and that's why we want to keep you well informed. The discovery significantly lowers the number of medium-sized asteroids near Earth to 19,500, nearly a 50% drop from the 35,000 space rocks initially estimated, and suggests that the threat to Earth by dangerous asteroids may be somewhat less than previously thought. So NASA officials say, don't worry about it and go back to the mall. There are still thousands more of these asteroids, which can measure up to 3,000 feet wide, that remain to be found. My question is, how do you know? I mean, if you haven't found it, how do you know it's 3,000 feet wide? Thousands more, 3,000 feet wide? Is this a mathematical estimation that you're making? Or is there really a, oh, crap, asteroid out there that you haven't found? And I can just tell you right here at X Squared Radio, we see right through this feel-good article that was released by NASA. There is no possible way they could have scanned the entire sky. They don't have enough telescopes. They don't have enough money to scan the entire sky for near-Earth objects. That's being done by amateurs. And if you're an amateur astronomer, Or you know an amateur astronomer, there's one in every single town of this nation. I can tell you that right now. You do a search for an observatory in your town. I don't care how small it is. You'll find somebody out there that has a scope that's connected to a computer, and they're taking digital photographs of the sky. There may be 50,000 telescopes in the United States alone looking at the sky. If you're one, or you know one in your neighborhood, and they find something, they can call here at X Squared Radio anytime, 24 hours a day. You can write me, and I'll get the news out. Don't call NASA first. Call them second. Anyway, while this story was being printed on the 29th of September, we had two close calls on the 28th. And the 29th, and the 30th. A small asteroid zipped by Earth well inside the orbit of the moon on September 30th. The second space rock encounter for our planet this week. Both asteroids posed no threat to Earth, scientists say. All right, here's the detail. Small asteroid 2011 SM-173... just passed Earth at a safe distance of 180,000 miles. That's like on our doorstep, people. That's between us and the moon. 0.8 lunar distances. SM-173 was discovered yesterday, by astronomers, and it's about 56 feet wide, making it about the size of a house. Its flyby came just 4 days after the pass of another space rock, the asteroid 2011 SE-58, which actually came even closer to Earth. This is a 33-foot wide asteroid. SE 58 slipped by within 147,000 miles of Earth. You could feel the breeze on that one when it went by. And that was just last Monday. Yeah, these are in the neighborhood, but the thing that gets me, that makes my BS detector go off here, you can see it's a big red thing. It's a big red thing right here. Right. I'm pointing at it. Oh, you can't see it. But anyway, it's a big red thing, BS detector. is that they only discover these maybe a few hours before they enter into our neighborhood. And some of these, you know, both of these were too small to threaten Earth with a serious impact, although they would have made one heck of a fireball. But rocky asteroids the size of SE-58 are not considered hazardous because they kind of break up in the atmosphere. But as they get bigger, you know, a couple hundred feet across, they don't break up in the atmosphere. They can strike the ground, and not just like somebody throwing gravel out on the parking lot either. NASA's asteroid census has discovered about 90% of the largest near-Earth asteroids and revealed that the population of mid-sized space rocks, these are 3,300 feet, is far lower than previously thought. And we do have these frequent flybys. Some of these are sort of in orbit. That is to say, they come around year after year, and they get a little closer each time. Now, you know, we have YU-59, I think, is coming through next month on the 9th. Now, this is a Haas. This is a pretty good-sized asteroid, and it's going to pass right by the Moon and the Earth. It's not going to go in between the Moon and the Earth. The Moon and the Earth are going to be on a parallel course or a parallel position with the course of this asteroid. So as it goes by, it's going to be affected by both the Moon's gravity first and then the Earth's gravity. And it's going to pass pretty close. We should be able to see it with a pair of binoculars. So that's the one you have to watch for. By the way, that coincidentally is the same day that the emergency alert system is going to be used. That's a national seizure of all airwaves. Everything except cell phones will be converted to this EAS system. All local satellite channels, all cable channels, all public TV channels, and all radio channels will be tied in. And this is the entire nation, not a local one. This is a national one. And we'll get a single message. And that's coincidentally the same day that this large asteroid comes by. NASA scientists and astronomers around the world keep a constant watch on the skies for potentially dangerous asteroids. And that's actually not a true statement. Many of these telescopes are contracted. Their time is purchased for many, many months out in the future, and they're not looking for NEOs. This is an afterthought. This is something that many of the space organizations around the world are having to mobilize for. Things like LNN and the attention that you all on the internet paid to LNN is what is alerting them and allowing them to get the revenue, the tax money, to begin watching some of these near-Earth objects. But they're nowhere near geared up. The private sector is way better geared up. And you can call them scientists, maybe you can call them astronomers, maybe I call them amateurs. Somewhere out there, somebody's going to ring the red phone here at X-Squared Radio and say, something in the dark is creeping up on us, it's coming up behind us, or we're about to hit it. And I'm just giving you a couple days' warning. The next object expected to fly close by Earth will be asteroid 2009 TM8, which will pass just inside the Moon's orbit when it flies by. The asteroid last whipped by Earth in 2009, 2 years ago, when it came within 216,000 miles of Earth. This one's going to be a little closer than that. So this is one of those asteroids that is perennial. It comes around on a regular basis. So it's almost like it's in a long elliptical orbit that's going to cause there some problems. Also, I just want to let you know, the politics of watching space is getting kind of interesting. NASA head Ed Wyler is stepping down after 30 years at the helm. Kind of interesting. He started in, Weller joined NASA in 1979 as chief scientist for the Hubble Space Telescope. He led the agency's space science enterprise from 1998 to 2004 and served as director of the Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland from 2004 to 2008 when he was recalled to NASA headquarters here to run the Science Mission Directorate, a $5 billion portfolio comprising astrophysics, earth science, heliophysics, and planetary science. This is a quote from Charles Bolden. He said, Ed leaves an enduring legacy of pride and success that forever will remain a part of NASA's science history. His leadership helped inspire the public with each new scientific discovery and enabled NASA to move forward with new capabilities to continue to explore our solar system and beyond. The way I see it, this may be human sacrifice for cost overruns. NASA has been running with blinders on for 3 decades. You know it, and I know it. So who do you think should replace Mr. Wyler? I would welcome your calls if you want to become part of X-Squared Radio tonight. Toll-free anywhere in the country is 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. And anywhere outside the country or off planet, for that matter, 530-413-4511, 530-413-4511. If you need to step out, don't step away from X Squared Radio. Call us up on our conference line, 760-569-7676, and put in the passcode 192919#. And you'll be able to listen to X Squared Radio for the next 2 hours live. In fact, you can listen to any of BBS radio programs by calling this. But you can listen to us live, walk around the mall with that very informed smile on your face, because you'll know what's going on in the mysteries of the universe and the Earth. But if you got an idea who should replace Mr. Wyler, some have said Mr. Hoagland. I don't disagree or agree with that. I think we need somebody who is willing to admit that we might not be alone on this planet. I don't think there's anybody at NASA that will officially admit that, and thus not admitting that, they will naturally throw out data that disagrees with that lack of admission, or agrees with that lack of admission. I think we need to put somebody in there that has an open mind. I think we need to put somebody in there who can say, okay, we've got this 10-year plan. However, if something shows up in the sky that we're not expecting, we're going to report on it to the American people, to the world, for that matter. We're going to report on what we find in space. And we're going to give the truth to the people because they're humans and they live here with us. And we're not going to put out mysterious little safety messages to the NASA family while leaving the American public out in the cold. We're not going to tell our people that they can retire to secret underground bases, which we have built for our NASA family, while the public has to fend for themselves. If this new official thinks that we need to dig a hole in the ground and put some food in it, and it makes space for our scared little hind end should something pass a little bit close, or a strike up in the upper northwest or somewhere. By the way, a lot of people think that it would really be bad if an asteroid were to strike the ground. It would be, oh, definitely. But it would be worse if it struck the ocean. You don't think so? I mean, maybe not if you live in Kansas or Kentucky. But if you live on the coast, which 90% of the population of every country does, an asteroid strike in the water would be devastating, because you'd have tsunamis not a couple dozen feet high. You'd have them 1,000 or 2,000 feet high. And that would be that would just ruin your afternoon. Put it this way, if you were to have your car running in gear with your foot on the brake, headed away from the coast, and you saw the tsunami in your rearview mirror and you hit the gas, it would still be too late. That's how devastating it would be. Also, since we're looking out there in space, they've been looking at Mars a little bit more carefully, and they have found that the upper atmosphere of Mars contains up to 100 times more water than previously suspected, according to a new study that could change our understanding of the Martian climate and could suggest that more water existed on the surface of the red planet in its early history. Now, one thing that's always fascinated me, that there is evidence on the surface of Mars that water existed in, pooled together, flowing as a river or as a lake or at least as a glacier. And now it's not there anymore. Well, water is something that doesn't just go away. I mean, it's H2O. It's a very stable molecule. Oh, sure, it can sublimate and it can condense again and it can, freeze and it can evaporate into the air, but it doesn't go away. The water's still there. I would love to send a mission to Mars to drill. Just drill a couple thousand feet under the Martian soil and tell us what you find. Are there aquifers under the surface of Mars like there are everywhere under the surface of the Earth? That's a great question. That's a question that could be posed to a new head of NASA. I think that's one that high school kids could put together, a probe that could survive the trip to Mars, run a simple program, and drill a simple hole and tell us what they find in the hole. Don't you think that would be interesting? I do. Using data from the European Space Agency's Mars Express probe and NASA's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, astronomers determined that water in the upper Martian atmosphere undergoes a process known as supersaturation, something astronomers thought could not occur on the dry, dusty planet. Oh, would that have been under Mr. Ed Wyler's leadership? Yes, I do believe it was. Under most climate conditions, water vapor coalesces around dust and particles in the air. When such dust is sparse, climate models have long assumed that the excess water in the atmosphere on Mars is then converted to ice. But data from Mars Express SpyCam instrument shows otherwise. Really? I wonder when the data from Mars Express's SpyCam indicated this. Could it have been any time during the last 30 years? I reckon so. Quote, our observations show that as much as 10 to 100 times more water vapor can subsist in a state of supersaturation, Frank Montmessin of the Laboratoire Atmospheres at Milo, Observations Spéciales in France, told Space.com in an email interview. Montmessin is part of a team of astronomers led by Maltagliati Luca, also at LATMOS, who studied the data. I guess it didn't come through Ed. I take it all back. That was another space agency out there. Mr. Luca at LATMOS studied the data. When the atmosphere contains little to no dust, however, water cannot use it as a base. Instead, the water must remain in vapor stage, in a state known as supersaturation. The new research is detailed in September 30th edition of Journal Science. Montmessin says, existence of supersaturation has profound consequences for the migration and further persistence of water everywhere. on the planet. We call it rain. We call it fog. Since the conditions on Mars were thought to impede supersaturation rather than encourage it, the present climate models do not include the process and will need to be revised. I reckon so. The international team of astronomers analyzed an especially cold season of spring and summer in the northern hemisphere on Mars, but the changed perspective on water vapor around the North Pole has consequences for the entire planet. It's true. Every summer, when the sun shines at the North Pole, water sublimes or evaporates directly from ice into vapor. It doesn't melt. And it fills the atmosphere with moisture, Montmessin explained. Seasonally sublimed water from the North Pole allows the global amount of water contained in the atmosphere to double or triple. While most of that water returns to the North Pole again in the winter, wind blows some of it south. In the meantime, some of the South Pole's water moves north, and some of the water leaves the planet entirely. It is believed that Mars has lost a substantial fraction, if not a majority, of its primordial water by escape processes to space, Montmessin said. I am going to officially disagree with that. I don't think the water leaks out into space. I think Mars has enough gravity that it can keep that held to the planet. I think that there's not enough solar wind to strip away the atmosphere of Mars. I think the atmosphere of Mars was stripped away by some gravitational event in the past. Not sure what that was. Could have been a close pass from a planet. Could have been a gravitational wave from the inner parts of the galaxy. But I'm thinking that maybe that water that we see in that atmosphere of Mars. And by the way, some people think that Mars has an atmosphere about 1/1000th the density of Earth's, while others think that the atmosphere is probably a little less dense than that found on Everest, which is 8,444 meters above sea level. And if that's the case, it would be possible to breathe for very short periods of time. You know, it takes several weeks, if not months, to acclimate to the higher altitude on Everest. I've been to just under 19,000 feet there. I mean, you think you would need oxygen there, but you don't. You can walk around and you can look at rocks and you can observe rocks, because there's no vegetation whatsoever at that altitude. And you have to be careful spending lots of time up there, because there's also not a lot of atmosphere to protect you from the ultraviolet radiation, so you can end up with cataracts. And I don't mean the opposite of Lincoln Continental, I mean cataracts in your eyes. And the Tibetan people have lots of cataracts. The Swiss run a cataract removal a clinic there. They charge the Tibetan people $30 for a cataract operation, and they do thousands of them a year to give vision back to the Tibetan people. Because although your skin can acclimatize to it, although seeing a 9-year-old with wrinkles like a 90-year-old woman can kind of tug your heart a little bit, the eyes are the eyes, and they just don't get tough, and blindness is quite common. But only a fraction of the water on Mars reaches the upper level of the atmosphere, where it's broken up into hydrogen and oxygen atoms that escape into space. The rest of it stays pretty low because of the gravity of Mars. But if more water is present, it means a larger quantity is able to escape. Well, of course, it's a partial pressure law of gas law. I believe it's Dalton's law that pertains to that. But I still would like to know what the subterranean water content of Mars is. And I think you would too. I think it would make a neat experiment. And not unlike the moon is also discovered to have a lot of water locked up in its soil. I think the moon has even less atmosphere than Mars. That's pretty much a consensus. But that doesn't mean that we couldn't access one of the many lava vents on the moon, travel back in there a few thousand feet, set up a wall on the inside and make a nice secure base on the inside of the moon. Tap into some of that water and some of that H3, have energy, have oxygen, and the ability to survive on the moon. Although it'd be a dismal place to be stranded or even assigned for a long period of time, it would still be interesting. Along the same notes, because we were talking about space exploration here in the first hour tonight, I guess I'm having some emotion here, and I will try to keep it out of my voice and try not to be so so exciting or excited, excitable, anxious about this. But China has a new space station. And it's going to be about the same size when it's fully built as the International Space Station, except that it won't be the International Space Station. China's about, well, they've already taken the first step, but they're, because the Chang'e 1 has been launched. Chang'e, by the way, means heavenly place. Heavenly place. It's already up. You can already find it on Heavens Above. It's going to make a, well, it just made a pass about an hour ago over the eastern seaboard of the United States. Although it doesn't put out a lot of light because it doesn't have its solar panels out yet. So it's about a 3.2. As you know, if you look at the flare scale, the more negative the number, the smaller the number, the brighter the object. So 3 is not going to be that visible. You're really going to have to look for it. It's a large cylindrical section that has been put into space. They'll be launching the next few sections and putting them together, beginning to build that over the years. And it's the first single nation that has ever put up a space station. In July, China joined a club of the select few nations to also do deep sea submersibles, and they broke the U.S. record diving deeper than 5,000 meters. And this Chang'e is going to be a full-size space station, very similar in structure to the International Space Station, and it's all going to be owned by China. I can tell you this, he who owns space owns Earth. Although we have a lot of satellites out there that might be aimed at the space station, or at least listening to it. And the private space race game is on. Long Beach, California, private space companies will launch American astronauts into orbit years before NASA is ready to do so on its own again. But the race to be first commercial space taxi service is still far from won. And I think there's a lot of, once this gets going, I think there'll be room up there for a space restaurant. One of my friends, Alex, who writes in during the program, says that he would like to open a space restaurant up there, which I think would be pretty cool. Although, I gotta tell you, I've done scuba diving after a Egg McMuffin and a hash brown, and I can tell you, at 100 feet, that was the last thing in the world I wanted in my stomach. If you're going to have a restaurant in space, you better be considering that weightless environment. Yeah, it's going to have to be something maybe not fried. Just my you know, suggestion. You might want to work up that weightless appetite. To test it out, you'd have to go up in an airplane and then dive the airplane so that you go weightless and just, you know, see if you're going for the bag or not. If you are, it's probably smart not to put that on the menu. NASA's next crew-carrying rocket, the Heavy Lift Space Launch System, will blast off its first test flight in 2017 at the earliest. Let's see, it's 2011. Oh, that's 6 years from now. Wow, the race is on. Anyway, a handful of private companies say they're on schedule to begin lofting astronauts by 2015, or perhaps even earlier. I believe that, too, because They don't have floors and floors and floors of government employees drinking tax dollars like a fire hose. No, they'll be a little bit more frugal. Quote, "We believe we'll be ready in 3 years," said Gwynn, and you're going to love this name. I'm telling you, you're going to love this name. I'm going to start over again because you just have to get the full impact of this. If this isn't out of a Salvage One television series episode, I don't know what is. If you're too young to remember what Salvage One is, our good buddy Andy of Mayberry, who lives here in North Carolina, very supportive of North Carolina politics and job creation, still a fantastic hometown American, Andy of Mayberry, Andy Griffith, had a television program that ran for one or two seasons called Salvage One. He ran a junkyard. And in his junkyard, he was a retired scientist. What he did is he built a ship that would go up and would grab space junk and bring it back. And he would salvage it. And occasionally, of course, NASA wouldn't have the budget to do what needed to be done. Well, they'd get a hold of Andy's crew, and he'd jump in Salvage One, which was really cool because it had like an American Motors automatic transmission shifter, you know, like you find in a Javelin. That was, you know, one of the controls. I just thought it was way cool. Anyway, it was a great program, and this is right out of it. Okay, I'm going to start again. "We believe we'll be ready in 3 years," said Gwynn Shotwell, president of Space Exploration Technologies Corporation, also known as SpaceX. Shotwell and a half dozen other representatives of private spaceflight companies spoke Wednesday, that was the 28th, during a panel presentation at the American Institute of Astronautics and Aeronautics. That was their Space 2011 conference. I think that's just as cool as it can be. NASA is happy about the progress SpaceX and other companies seem to be making. I reckon so. They don't have the budget to do anything about it. And I think almost to a person, they're very passionate about putting metal and men into space. And they're very unhappy that the administration has chosen to literally gut their program to put into other things that they don't seem to think are so important. The agency is not in competition with these firms, after all. Hang on while I pull my tongue out of my cheek. Rather, NASA is encouraging them to develop their capabilities via its commercial crew development program. In the last several years, the agency has given money to a handful of firms, including SpaceX, Boeing, Sierra Nevada Corporation, and Blue Origin, in two rounds of funding. The goal is to help establish American means of human transportation to space again, an ability the nation has lacked since the retirement of NASA's space shuttle fleet in July. And by the way, I would like to say that those space shuttles, although they have been retired, they're still space ready, folks. They're hit sitting in a hangar. They haven't been mothballed yet. If something came up, believe me, the right leadership could snap things too, and we could get back into space. I think we got William from Pennsylvania on line 3. Welcome to the program, William.
Thank you, Mr. Agnew. How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing really good out here in the cool evening of North Carolina. How are you?
Doing good. I was very much thinking about your that the space shuttles are not mothballed at all, and that you're very much right. In fact, from what I understand, the new shuttle that's going to be coming forward actually has a gravity generator in it, and they will be able to leave orbit, actually. And
wow!
Aspects of, yeah, there are some real aspects that, you know, what you're saying that NASA has, NASA hasn't really produced very much of anything in the last 20 years, and you'd really just need about $200 and some common sense to really do much of anything. It's just now, it's coming forward that there's life on Mars, and they're starting to let that out of the bag, even though a lot of us know that there is and have so for a long time. NASA had been stating Mars as being 8 millibar atmospheric pressure out of 1,000, which is ludicrous. I mean, 8 millibar, that's a near-perfect vacuum, and at ground level, unless you're NASA, the atmosphere doesn't get thicker higher up, so what's the parachute for?
Yeah, you're exactly right. And, we have lots of evidence that there are striations in the deserts of Mars. We've seen dust storms on Mars. And you can see those with a pair of binoculars from Earth. A good pair of binoculars or a backyard telescope. You can see the dust storms on Mars. I'm sorry, William, I agree with you. There's no way you get dust storms with 8 millibars of atmospheric pressure.
That's right. That's right. Earth is one bar, 1,000 plus millibar. Now they find water. water, just to give people an idea, water in a near perfect vacuum, if there was such a thing, is not happening, not even for NASA, not even for NASA's budget.
That's right. That's what we call freeze drying. It takes a certain amount of partial pressure to keep hydrogen and oxygen together. If the vacuum gets too low, it goes to completely the vapor state and breaks apart. So in order for ice to exist, you just have to have more atmospheric pressure than 8 millibars. I think it's pretty close to that which that we experience on Everest. That's what I think.
Yes. Well, the atmosphere is really around 870 millibar. It's kind of the equivalent of being around 14,000 foot altitude.
Wow, that's nothing. I've been higher than that. I mean, it's a little bit like climbing stairs while breathing through a drinking straw, but it's not too bad, actually.
Yeah, I mean, if you're there for a good length of time, you more than likely will get a severe headache. I used to climb up to Mount White as a predecessor to some training that will be disclosed later at a later date. And right around the 14,500 altitude it would take 15 steps and rest for 10 minutes.
Yeah, 15 steps and rest for 10 minutes. Yeah, I remember getting off the plane at Lhasa in Tibet. It was 11,500 feet, and the guide said, "Do not pick up your luggage, shuffle to the hotel, and go to bed." And that's exactly what we did. But, I mean, I've been that high, pretty close to that high here in the States. But you go up and you come down. You go up and you stay there for a couple of days, and it wears on you.
Yeah. You do get tired.
Yeah.
Running any marathons.
That's exactly right. Well, listen, I really appreciate the phone call. You call back anytime. I've got to take a quick break for whoever wants to run a commercial. We don't here. We'll run some music. But I really appreciate the call, and you can call back anytime.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, William. Bye-bye. All right, Earth Explorers, we will take a quick break, play a little bit of music for you, take a breather, and we'll be back in about 4 minutes. Thanks.
xradio.com.
All right, welcome back to X Squared Radio. We're glad you're here with us tonight. We're coming to you live from Eastern North Carolina. And we're going to be going live here on VBS Radio in about 5 seconds. And you should be able to hear us very clearly out there. All right, welcome back. Our IQ window forecast tonight is about 64 degrees on a clear evening in North Carolina. By the way, North Carolina has what many believe is the clearest skies on the eastern seaboard. Kind of an interesting situation we have. And I think we've got another caller on the line, so let's just start out the hour. Jeff from Pennsylvania, welcome to the program.
Hi, Brooks. How are you tonight?
I'm doing wonderful. Good to hear from you.
Hey, I was wondering if you could speak to a topic that may or may not relate to space-based communications. I'm looking for information because I'm starting to research the topic, and I'm hoping that with your breadth of knowledge, you've run across it at some point in the past. Can you speak to or have any experience with radionics?
I'm not familiar with the term radionics in that particular sense, but I know space-based communications, we're doing a lot of it because, you know, we have a lot of satellites up there that receive radio from Earth, and then we relay it back down to other stations on the Earth, and that's how we get kind of get global radio. But we're also listening for signals that come from out there. We have large dishes both on the surface of the planet and out in space that are listening for any kind of signals coming in from out there. So what exactly did you have in mind for space-based communications?
Well, I'm not certain, and the reason I'm asking you this is because I'm not certain I even understand the concept myself. Supposedly, Maxwell's original equations had two waveforms that were 100% out of phase. So when they were added together, you canceled the two out and got zero as a result. And supposedly, you actually got a double in gravity. So my assumption, and it's probably erroneous, is that they were creating graviton waves. So I don't know if that's analogous to a scalar wave or not, but I thought perhaps maybe if you were familiar with scalar waves, you might be able to tell whether or not there's been any experimentation with such things for communications.
I don't know about communication. We use it in precision measuring all the time. We call it interferometry. What we do is take two signals, either radio signals are kind of hard to do it with, but light waves are easier to do it with because we can polarize them and we can control them. They don't go out in 360 degrees in every direction. And we shift it 90 degrees out of phase so that the peak of one wave is actually hitting the valley of a wave that's overlaid on it. And what you get is a net zero. They cancel each other out, and you literally get a dark spot. Now, as long as both signals stay completely in stasis, that's exactly what you're going to get, a dark spot. And what I mean by that is the frequency control for both lasers has to be unwavering. That's where most of the electronics comes in. No drift at all, not even a fraction of a nanometer. And the other is that the distance between them has to stay exactly the same. That's why we use it in vibration analysis. We will shoot a laser, for instance, at the surface of the case of a little gearbox. And as long as that case isn't vibrating, then we have a certain signal coming back. But if that case is vibrating, even a little bit, then the length of that laser is changing infinitesimally, and we get a corresponding signal. So we use interferometry to measure vibration. We use it to measure distance. That's how we measure the distance between the Earth and the Moon, which we do on a regular basis. We shoot a laser from the Earth to the Moon. It bounces off a reflector, which was placed by scientists on the Moon back to the Earth, and that that timing of that wave is what we use to measure that distance. So, and we also
using the differential, taking many samples, and you're actually plotting a sigma to see what the differential turns out to be and what the envelope for it is.
Yep, that's exactly right. And then there's a little bit of, you know, error there. There's statistical error depending on how long the wave is. Both observatories in the U.S., the one in Hanford, Washington, and the one in Livingston, Louisiana, which are the laser interferometer gravitational wave observatories, use exactly the same technology. Now, I've been in the control room of both facilities, and just the electronics and the computer switching is just blows your mind. It takes literally $10 million a year to run this facility. There's so much technology in it.
That's impressive. The black spot you had mentioned, has there been any attempt to modulate that?
I'm not really sure. I know one of the things that they do with the two observatories is they try to get them both looking at space at the same time, or both turned on at the same time. That's been a challenge, not only from a funding standpoint, but also a technological standpoint, because the tubes down which the lasers go have to be evacuated of air, and the tubes are, well, the one in Livingston is much older than the one in Hanford, but the tubes are prone to leaks. They're 4 kilometers long. All the air has to be evacuated out of them, which takes several weeks, which means those pumps have to be running for, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for weeks to get the air out of those tubes. And I think this month, October of this year, both units are going to be running at the same time. Now, and when that's the case, then they modulate the black spot between the two facilities. And the reason they do that is to tune out local disturbances like trucks driving by, earth tremors, waves crashing on the beach, lightning, you know, I mean, thunder, stuff like that. It only happens at one location or the other. It doesn't happen at both. So they tune those events out, and then what's left are extraterrestrial signals.
Those tubes, are they actually waveguides?
They're not waveguides. They're just air tubes. They're tall enough that you can, you know, drive a vehicle down them. And they literally are fascinating to see. I could send you some photos of them that I took. If you want me to, I can send you those. Just blows your mind to stand there. Yeah, write me at bagnew at x2-radio or Skype me at x2-radio, and I'll be happy to send you my pictures of those tubes. It's quite fascinating to see something that's so long it goes over the horizon.
I see your point. That would be pretty impressive. All right, very good. I appreciate the answer, and I think you actually answered my question on that, because it sounds to me like that differential that they're using is the same thing. It'll be interesting to see when I start looking up some of those keywords you gave me, what I pick up from that. So you have a good evening, and thanks very much for what you're doing.
Thanks so much, Jeff. Thanks for calling. Call back anytime. All right, that was Jeff from Pennsylvania. We're always glad to have callers here. If you want to join us about anything, and in this hour and in the third hour, we're gonna get into some controversy, not because of conspiracies or anything like that, but just because in the next 12 months, I really want to keep you aware of the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. And right now, we've got some mysterious economic science and political science going on, and I want to get you involved in that in a big way. I have the opportunity to have some of the candidates to come on X Squared Radio for a couple of minutes, answer some questions that we have that we want to ask them. That if you have questions that you want to ask the candidates, though, and by that I don't mean on the Democratic side, although we're still not sure if Obama's going to be the nominee. We assume that he is, but we're not sure. In the other side of the camp, or should I say the other two sides of the camp, we have the Republican and we have Libertarian members of the nomination, potential nomination, that are running under the Republican ticket, which I thought was just brilliant. In years past, we've seen libertarians run as libertarians, and people are just not willing to throw that vote up a horse's rear. But now the libertarians are running under the Republican ticket, and I find it interesting, especially from the point of view that 20 years ago, we weren't really ready to pay attention to the libertarian point of view. And they would preach every year on the, you know, their platform of excessive federal debt, of poor foreign policy, and they would put out in their videos and their pamphlets that they put out that continuing a policy of imperial dominion over the world is going to get us hated everywhere. And we were having none of it. You know, we voted Republican, and when the Republicans decided, well, it's McCain's turn to run, it's Dole's turn to run, then that's the guy that ran. And that's just the Republican way. And what happened was they lost election after election after election to Democrats who were running much more passionate and ideological candidates. And now, finally, we're really at a very amazing place in our political science where the libertarian point of view has been drawn under the wing of the Republican Party, but they don't know that they've drawn a fox under the wing. It's not a hen. And the interesting thing is, the very powerful thing is, that the American people are beginning to resonate with the libertarian point of view. And that's what's really making for an interesting setup. And I don't think that the mainstream media is covering this. I don't even think that the other talk radio programs that you hear on various AM stations around the country are covering this. I think that there is a very mysterious, politically scientific phenomenon that's occurring in the sociology of Americans, that the libertarian point of view has caught fire. And the interesting thing is, it's burning so brightly, and yet the mainstream media just puts sunglasses and fireproof clothing on and they pretend it doesn't exist. We see it, we hear it, but they don't. So in the next 12 months, beginning this month, we're going to start talking about that fire right here on X Squared Radio. Feel passionate about it? I want you to call in. Tell me your thoughts. You'll be treated well, because everything put into the formula of X Squared comes out positive. And it's going to be refreshing. Not that I want to make this a political talk show. It isn't, but there is a political science to it that is highly interesting, and the sociological patterns and contagion that is slowly working its way to formula pitch is interesting. That's what we want to look at. I want to talk a little bit more about this private effort to get astronauts into space. By the way, these aren't, you know, hey, let's put some helmets on and go into space. No, they're actually going to take real astronauts into space. These are private efforts that are beefing up the capability of making this happen. You know, all great things don't come from the government. Yeah, I know. I'm with you about that. I get it. But all great things don't come from the government. When asked to speculate about when they'd be ready to begin carrying astronauts to the space station, which means they'll have to be docking with it, I don't think anybody's going to say, okay, we're opening the door, launch over there, catch the net, and pull yourself in. No, they're going to have to dock to the space station. The panelists didn't seem to flinch or hem or haw. Oh, I like this. I mean, it was like, well, we're not exactly sure, you know, that we can dock with it. It's, you know, we're just not ready for that. Shotwell. I just love that name. Come on. You just don't get a better name than that as, you know, the leader of an organization. I just think it's marvelous. Her name is Gwynne Shotwell. She's the president of Space Exploration Technologies Corporation, also known as SpaceX. I just think the world of her right now. I just think the world of her. She, her estimate of 3 years before the first manned flight of SpaceX's Dragon capsule was the most aggressive, but her colleagues laid out similar time frames. Sierra Nevada Corporation Chairman Mark Sirangelo, for example, said his company's Dream Chaser, which looks a bit like a miniature space shuttle, should be ready for crew-carrying operations by 2015. Boeing's John Mulholland also marked 2015 for the operational start of that firm's CST-100 vehicle. You see, these big quasi-government organizations, they always have names like CST-100 or something like that. But I like the name Dream Chaser. I just think that's really cool. Before we continue on with Blue Origin, which was set up by Amazon.com founder Jeff Bezos, I want to see if we can get Alex on the phone. Alex, welcome to the program.
Hey, Brooks.
Hey, Alex.
I was hearing you talking about this private space thing, and you know, it's always been a passion of mine, space travel and scientific research in space and all that. I even had a dream once of actually becoming an astronaut, but the education's too expensive.
Yeah, anyway. And then you also have to join the Air Force, and then you have to, you got to be able to fly a plane and take 9 Gs and all that stuff.
It's not a civilian. It's not a civilian career. Let's just say that. No matter how much they say it's a civilian space agency, nope, Americans, it's not. Anyway, I came in because, or I called in because, you know that that movie that came out a few years ago called Astronaut Farmer?
Oh, yeah. Wasn't that a great movie? I thought that was really
bad. Oh, I loved that movie. Even though I was, like, I was a little taken aback when I found out that what he was fueling his rocket on was refined kerosene.
Yeah, that's right.
In other words, jet fuel or some such nonsense.
Yeah, Jet A. That doesn't sound like enough fuel to get a rocket into space. We use hydrogen peroxide now.
Yeah. Anyway, that's what I thought they used. And then I was like, well, in my high school science books, they basically said what you're looking at is a hydrogen-oxygen combustion that they use to get rockets into space and everything. And I was like, that's... Actually, nowadays, there are several really interesting homebrew technologies that you can get quite a bit of. I think it's called HHO or Brown's gas out of, which is supposed to be highly efficient as far as combustion is concerned.
Oh, yeah, and you can make your own HHO.
Water for fuel method?
Yeah, exactly. You use electrolysis to make it. And there are other methods, you know. There's a method called metal gasification, where you actually set laser, and you shoot the laser at the bottom of the spacecraft, and it has a metal base with a nozzle, and the laser actually shoots right down the nozzle. It's a line to the bottom of the craft. And the expanding gas from the exploding metal is what launches the craft into the air, and it doesn't have to carry any fuel at all.
Yeah. Anyway, what I was saying is there are so many really inexpensive ways that you could fuel actual spacecraft that, heck, you could probably design something within a few Well, I'm not sure. Probably a year minimum to that could carry, say, a robotic something into space, and 2 years maximum for human spaceflight. Really cheap.
Yeah, and as long as your human is wearing a spacesuit, then it's not too bad. I mean,
yeah,
you don't
exactly.
have a whole lot of...
It's probably the spacesuit that takes the... Well, does it take that long to design a spacesuit?
Well, it only has to hold 14.7 pounds per square inch if you're going to keep someone at sea level. If you're going to keep them at, you know, 7 to 10,000 feet, then it takes substantially less to get it... to hold, but it just has to be airtight, you know, not unlike the it doesn't matter if it leaks a little bit, as long as you're making more, enough to keep pressure on the inside, because otherwise all the gases that are in solution in human blood will turn to gas and they'll come out, and you'll literally suffer from the bends. And it won't look a little bit like what they show on television. Really, not unlike that at all.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
anyway, I find it fascinating. I'm fascinated by private companies taking a shot at space flight. I think they can do it and do it profitably. They do it all the time, launching satellites. The French are making a fortune off of it.
Right. Oh, by the way. I absolutely agree with you about that Apollo 18 movie that came out, Monster Flick. Absolutely horrible.
Don't, please, Alex, anyway. Don't tell me you went out and spent money to watch it.
No, I didn't actually. I was smart and watched it streaming online.
There you go. I mean, you probably spent about what it was worth. You know, they had a good storyline there. That's the thing. But the, you know, my analysis of it, the screenplay was awful. It was taking advantage of all the gotcha kind of film techniques that they use on old horror flicks. And they had a great storyline. They could have really done something neat with that movie.
They could have. As a matter of fact, I thought they were going to go into astronauts making alien contact on the moon and being told to come back down to Earth before there and stay there until they were prepared to go back to space or something like that. And it was a total disappointment, you know.
Well, if you want to see a private space shot to the moon at its best, there is a movie, old movie, I think it was done in the 50s or 60s. It's in color. It's called, I think it's not Journey to the Center of the Moon, but it's Journey to the Moon or something like that. I've got the video. It's really, the acting is superb and the storyline is amazing. I was just fascinated by it. It was an English crazy scientist that develops an anti-gravity paint. And
that was H.G. Wells' Journey to the Moon. It was he called this anti-gravity laminate called Cavorite, and the. It was made out of a certain rare mineral on Earth, or an artificially made mineral, that reflected gravity waves. And wherever you pointed this thing, it would repel the object that was trying to pull the material toward it. And they got to the moon that way.
Yep, they used the Earth gravity.
Sales is basically what it amounted to.
Yeah, and it was a cool storyline because you had these beings that lived inside the moon. And I'm not going to tell you the rest of it. You have to buy the video for yourself, listeners. But Alex, you're exactly right. Cavorite, I remember. That was really a cool movie. Well done.
Yeah. Anyway, I guess I'd better let you get to the rest of your callers.
Well, I appreciate you calling in, Alex, and I always appreciate you texting in, too. Alex sends us stuff here during the program, and it keeps us on our toes, and we really appreciate you. Thanks so much.
I enjoy it. Thank you very much.
All right.
Have a good night. Bye.
So we have these private efforts, and they're so fascinating. The CST-100 vehicle from Boeing is also going to be ready in 2015. And Blue Origin, which was set up by Amazon.com founder Jeff Bezos, has been pretty much tight-lipped about its plans. But the company's Rob Meyerson gave some specifics today. He says, in our proposal with the government funding that we laid out, we believe between 2016 and 2018, Meyerson said. Sierra Nevada, Boeing, and Blue Origin have arranged for their craft to fly to space aboard Atlas V rockets, which are operated by the American company United Launch Alliance. SpaceX will launch Dragon aboard its own Falcon 9 rocket. You see, that's just better. You know, Gwynne Shotwell has her game on. I mean, with a craft called Dragon and its launch vehicle called Falcon 9, it doesn't get any better than that. That's better than Salvage 1. I just love it. The Atlas V should be ready for these launches by 2015 as well, according to ULA officials. Mike Holguin is with ULA, and he says, we'll be there whenever they need us. For a nominal fee. Yes. Fascinating stuff. I'm just all turned on about private spaceflight. I think it's way cool. It's something that private industry should have been allowed to do for a long, long time. Not just use the Atlas V, but also use the Falcon 9 or the any other method that can be used to get into space. And by the way, I think there's a great, great potential multi-trillion dollar business. You could make money at this, and you could pay for something so vital to development of Earth technology by scooping up all the space junk in space. Just going up with a big trash truck and just picking up things and bringing it back to Earth, selling it back to those people who are responsible for that. You know, they're bound by treaty to recover their own space junk, but I don't see anybody lining up. So if a private company said, by the way, we'll go collect the space junk, you make your space treaty good, and you pay cost plus when we bring this stuff back. It's just interesting stuff. If you want to be part of the program, don't forget our toll-free number anywhere in North America, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us. And by the way, if you're off planet, you better hurry up, because there's a 500 kilometer per second wind coming your way from a double-barreled shotgun blast CME that launched out yesterday from the sun. Two sunspots working like two barrels of a shotgun just launched a tremendous CME toward Earth, although it's slow moving, not really up there in the 700 or 800 or 900 kilometer per second range. This is something that's going to create one heck of a light show and maybe a little geomagnetic storm, but nothing to really play havoc with your iPhone. So your electronic world is safe. Anyway, that number is 530-413-4511. 530-413-4511. If you have to step away, I don't recommend it, but if you have to step away, you can do this. You can call in our conference line, 760-569-7676, and then dial the passcode 192-919-pound, and you can listen to the program live, and you won't be able to respond to us, but except with hand signals, which are a little hard for me to see from here, but you'll be able to listen to the program live. Now, We're going to get a little bit into the political science area the remainder of this hour. We've got about 15 minutes in this hour and then all next hour, because we are entering into a metamorphosis as a society. We are beginning to make the change from sheeple, that's a cross between sheep and people, you know, that's what I'm talking about. It means that you follow the rest of the sheep over the cliff. But we're beginning to make a metamorphosis as a nation. It's a strange thing to see because, you know, shaking the carrot every single day on the mainstream news used to turn the heads of all Americans. We would say, oh, he's not electable. Oh, that's going to be the new nominee. And, you know, if the Democrats don't get their act together, then the Republicans win. And that's kind of what it is. It's the less worse prepared candidate that gets elected. Yeah, I think I put that right. The less worst candidate that gets elected. And for about 20 years, we've had a libertarian faction in our political science that's been getting more and more, I wasn't going to say mainstream, that's not really the word I'm looking for, getting more and more palatable to people. You know, back in the old John Birch days, it was just a little too radical, you know, like sort of Aryan race, blah, blah, blah. However, the modern libertarian view has taken the stance that federal government has things that it does well. In fact, it has things that are assigned to it by the Constitution. Everything else that it does, all of the agencies, departments, and bureaus, none of that is constitutional. That is to say, the Environmental Protection Agency, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the Department of Education, the Department of, you know, this, and the agency of that, and the administration of this. It goes on and on and on, and these groups use court precedent to build their own regulations, and they have now consumed most of the budget. Our budget is about 42% to 43% over what we take in. And the libertarians have been trying to explain to us for 20 years that that's not sustainable. Eventually, we're going to be unable to pay the interest on the debt, and we're going to get downgraded on our credit, and shortly thereafter, we're going to go the big B. Yeah, the big bankrupt. We're going to be Greece on a big scale. It's going to be a Greece slick. That's what it's going to be. The whole Western Hemisphere is going to be tanked. Now, the United States used to lead the world for a long, long time, well over 100 years, maybe 150 years, we led the world in a lot of areas. Yes, we were young and stupid compared to other nations. We had our adolescence. We had our prejudices. We had our stupidity and our ready, shoot, aim kind of mentality. But we outgrew it. We matured. We learned that everybody belongs everywhere on the bus and in every restaurant. We believe that everybody belongs in every school. And we also we grew away from being a nation of achievers to being a nation of accommodators. And that began happening on a governmental scale that just cannot be sustained. So, that being said, we have seen the example of other nations and what they have done to solve their problems, and it's worked. And it's worked very well. And it's been repeatable, which is a nice scientific experiment. When someone comes up with a hypothesis, they develop an experiment, and they test the hypothesis, and the hypothesis comes out to be true. And then other people take the same test parameters and test the hypothesis as well in their laboratory, and it turns out to be true. And after a while, we in the scientific community will agree that we have some postulates, some axioms, and we have some facts that we're going to go by. We have theories that have held well for decades and You know, they just seem to hold up, and we can use them as an anchor for deciding other things. Not so with court precedent. Court precedent has very carefully, meticulously been manipulated to generate a certain outcome. One precedent relying upon another, relying upon another, and in a system of very twisted and methodical logic, much like the criminal mind, they put together a program that seems to rip the country apart without anybody being able to do anything about it. So what we are getting ready to go into is going to be very controversial, but it's going to be important, and I want you to pay attention to it because, you know, this is something that affects a lot of people. It affects more people, I think, than get paychecks, and that is the system of food stamps. Now, I've listened to it talked about repeatedly on the radio, and I have to tell you, food stamps have their place. When I was in college, I had four small kids at home. I couldn't work full-time and take these upper-level classes and spend all the hours I had to spend in the lab and get good grades in order to get the degree to be able to support my family. And so I found myself, for the last 2 years of college, on food stamps. If it wasn't for food stamps, I wouldn't be here as having the credentials that I have. And I have repaid the cost of those food stamps, which was, what, $200-$300 a month, if that, many, many thousands of times over. And so has everyone who has been in college, been on food stamps. And it has, of late, been utilized in a corruptive way. And not by the recipients. You know, there are certain guidelines that you have to go through to get food stamps. First, you have to have kids, and you have to have a need. And largely, at least most states, the way they administer it, even though it's a federal program, a federally subsidized program administered by the states through their Department of Employment Security and their Health and Human Services offices, you have to have a need. You have to have a financial need, and you have to be in some kind of training program. It is not meant to be a way of life. It is meant to be a way of hand up. However, in its quest to promote taxpayer-funded entitlement programs, the current administration has actually rewarded one state with a $5 million bonus for its efficiency in adding food stamp recipients to already bulging rolls. Yeah, I gotta tell you, I'm sitting here in disbelief as I read it, but it's a fact. An actual performance bonus was paid to one state because they were efficient in adding food stamp recipients to already bulging rolls. It's part of the administration's campaign to eradicate what it calls food insecure households by providing access and increasing participation in the government's Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, also called SNAP. Not Crackle or Pop, just SNAP. That's it, just SNAP. Incidentally, the program was recently changed to SNAP to eliminate the stigma that comes with a name like food stamps. So now it's called SNAP. Just a few months ago, the federal agency that administers the program, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, launched a multi-million dollar initiative to recruit more food stamp participants, even though the number of recipients has skyrocketed in the last few years. This week, and I'm going to name the state, and if you're in that state, you can call me, you can talk about it, it's okay. 888-429-5471. I don't mean anything by it, but facts are facts, and this is what we're going to talk about for this remaining of this hour and next hour. This week, Oregon officials bragged that the USDA has given the state $5 million in performance bonuses for ensuring that people eligible for food benefits receive them and for its swift processing of applications. That's their quote. That's their quote in Oregon. The money comes on the heels of a separate $1.5 million award from the feds for making accurate payments of food stamp benefits to clients. So, that's their quote. That's their point of view. It marks the fifth consecutive year that Oregon has been recognized by the federal government for exceptional administration of the entitlement program, according to the announcement posted on the state's Department of Human Services website. The state official who runs SNAP assures that her staff will, quote, continue working very hard to exceed expectations, close quote, so that Oregonians can, quote, put healthy foods on their table quickly, close quote. This could be why the number of food stamp beneficiaries Oregon has increased dramatically in the last few years. Since 2008, that's 3 years ago, since 2008, the state has seen a 60% boost in the number of food stamp recipients, which means that more than 780,000 people, one out of every five Oregonians, gets groceries, compliments of Uncle Sam. Well, on that note, we are going to take a 3.5 minute break. We'll play a little bit of bumper music, let you get another burrito, fill up whatever beverage you're drinking, loosen your seatbelt a little bit because you know the ride's going to get a little wild. But as long as you keep your arm inside the vehicle, you should be okay. We'll take a quick break here at X Squared Radio, about 3.5 minutes of music. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Well, all right. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. We're so glad that you're here with us live October 2, 2011. We're coming to you live from eastern North Carolina, where our AccuWindow forecast is about 62 degrees. It's going to be about 58 tonight. Nice and clear. You can come out to Catawba Sky Observatory and take a look at Jupiter. Quite fascinating little observatory out here in Catawba Sky. You can check them out, catawbasky.com. By the way, I appreciate all the people that have come into the archives this last month. It was a big help. It helped us keep the lights on here. If you want to be part of X Squared Radio, you're listening to us live and you missed something, it's no problem because you can subscribe at xsquaredradio.com to the archives, and we try to make the highest quality that we can here. We don't play any commercials anymore because those of you that have been subscribing to the archives, you cover the overhead. So you get the right to hear commercial-free radio live and also in the archives. It's easy to do. All you have to do is click on the subscribe button. You can join for as little as $2.50. Or if you want to listen for an entire year, and there are over 1,000 hours of archives at xsquaredradio.com, you can do so for $20 a year. That's less than the price of a cup of coffee per month. We also highly encourage you to do the same at bbsradio.com, because when you do that, you also support all the other hosts that are on BBS Radio and helps them keep their lights on as well. And believe me, there's so much content there that you don't ever have to listen to public radio ever again, and many, many fine hosts. By the way, our condolences go out to the family and friends of Dr. Fred Bell. Just so you know, Dr. Bell and I communicated many times over the years. Tremendously brilliant man, energy beyond measurement, and his spirit is felt everywhere. I just want you to know that if you have a chance to ever listen to any of the archives of Dr. Fred Bell, don't pass it up. He's been on our program a couple of times, and he's just one of those inventors extraordinaire that drives the imagination of all those people that hear him. Continuing on, we're going to spend this hour on political science because there are some really remarkable changes that are taking place in our society, and it's going to affect, and it's not just going to affect the elections. It's not something that you take sides on, and that's not the way I want to look at it or the way I want to treat it here on this program. But the way I want to approach this, and I would really appreciate your feedback on it, I want you to be part of it, because you're going to hear things here that you don't hear in the mainstream news. And no, we're not going to slam any particular candidate. We're not going to run anybody down. That's not what we do here. What I want to talk about is the phenomenon of this change, because we're about to undergo metamorphosis in our political community. Having made many visits to Washington, for me anyway, over the last year, I've kind of seen the way, not the political process, but the governmental process, how it works. Yes, there are some games that are played in the House, and there's one-upmanship, and there's this side of the aisle and that side of the aisle. And, by and large, I think that's pretty ridiculous, and so do you. How do I know that? Because I can see the polls. I can see how you're changing. And you're changing regardless of how the mainstream media or even the cable media wants to manipulate you. And I'm seeing it because you're speaking with your money. You're speaking with your ideology. And you're also speaking with your votes on these polls. And some of these polls have 30, 40,000 people responding to them. They're representative people. They are representative. Now, true, they are people that own computers, but that's a pretty broad cross-section these days. It's not like it was back in the late 90s where only techies had computers, because it wasn't really that friendly unless you had AOL, which I have no idea why you would have AOL, but if you got into the internet early, that's probably the browser that you used. It was by far the most popular, and many people just stuck with it. But now people are more computer savvy, and they're more computer populant, and they're using iPads and iPods, and they're using laptops with Wi-Fi, and they're connected, and I see people old enough to be my parents walking around texting each other, and I just think it's fantastic. But that's proof that we've gone through this metamorphosis, and we're going through an electronic metamorphosis because our neural net is being connected together in a way that it has never been before. And that's allowed us to change the way we do politics. And one of the most amazing things is there are candidates, which ordinarily you wouldn't suspect, but you know, one of the oldest candidates, he's 76 years old, Ron Paul, has become a master at it. And he's become a money-raising machine. And it doesn't raise it from corporations. He raises it from thousands and thousands of small donors. And it has allowed him to get his message out there, which really hasn't changed in 20 years. It's just now we're starting to listen. A study shows that the current cost of stopping corruption and fraud in the food stamp program is more than the fraud found. I know, it's hard to believe. Once investigating fraud is stopped, you can be assured fraud will explode at large in the system, since the crooks, illegal aliens, and others will know they can do what they want to do and no one will care. However, I feel it. Just take a deep breath, take another sip. All right, here we go. California's policy is meant to deter fraud, but it keeps people from seeking aid and creates high administrative costs, according to a study this month by the Public Policy Institute of California. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? California's policy is meant to deter fraud, but it costs too much money. Oh, my goodness. Participation in California's food stamp program, CalFresh, is much lower than in other states, but would rise about 7% if the state stopped fingerprint requirements. The state's administrative costs for the program, which are some of the highest in the country, would drop about 13%, according to the study. It's a win-win, said Carolyn Danielson, a study co-author. It's the biggest policy lever that we could identify. Legislation eliminating the fingerprinting process, AB6 by Assemblyman Philippe Fuentes, that's a good Irish Catholic name, Democrat from Arleta, is waiting for Brown's signature. It passed the legislature despite opposition from Republicans who argued that the requirements deter fraud, making it harder to get food stamps from multiple jurisdictions or using multiple identities. It's not about stopping fraud. Stop the fingerprinting and millions of illegal aliens will start getting food stamps. This is another effort by liberals to protect and promote illegal aliens with honest people paying the bills. And that's exactly right. That's exactly correct. By the way, one of our favorite Skypers writes in, Ron Paul gets his money because he's honest. There are more than one honest candidate. I think Newt Gingrich and Herman Cain and Rick Santorum, and I don't even know how to describe the others, but I know those are honest too. None of those men, no matter how much money you paid them, would ever, ever do a dishonest thing, and they wouldn't do anything to knowingly hurt the United States of America nor any citizen in it. Now, the administration appears to quietly be using food stamps to buy votes. Don't be shocked. Don't be shocked. This has been done since the 1700s, okay? Politicians buy votes. Oh, yeah. Believe me, they used to drive wagons down in the middle of town full of whiskey, and they would open the spigots and they would pour drinks and they would buy votes with whiskey. Yeah, well, they had to put some laws in place to put that, you know, stop. Then they used to pay them money, and then they put that to stop to that. Then they used to intimidate people at the polls to keep people from voting for certain candidates, and they put a stop to that. And all that's good. All that's good. If we could just keep the corruption out of voting, we'll be fine. But the corruption in purchasing votes is as old as politics itself. So don't get all in a rile. But I just want to make sure that you know what's going on. President Barack Obama's jobs speech before members of both houses of the U.S. Congress promised much in the way of government help for the unemployed and for economic growth. Hello? Unemployed and economic growth, aren't those kind of oxymorons? That is to say, if you don't have economic growth, you have higher unemployment. If you have an economic growth, you have lower unemployment. You know, it always amazes me how the parties in Washington climb over each other like dogs fighting for a media pork chop to see who's going to be the one to extend more employment benefits to Americans who are out of work. And they're the same politicians who will look the other way like they didn't hear anything, or they will slow walk, or they will block, or they will bury legislation that allows small business to have access to funds to put those same people to work. It always amazes me. It just blows my mind. But the speech failed to mention the abuse and corruption that exists in current government giveaways. I already said that I would not be here tonight speaking to you with the credentials that I have if it was not for the food stamp program. I know it works. It's only $200 or $300 a month, which is definitely not a whole lot to get corrupt about. It is in the form of food, not alcohol, not even paper products. It is not in the form of prepared products, so you can't go out to O'Charlie's or Longhorn and buy a steak and sit down and eat. But you can go to the grocery and you can buy groceries. And, you know, I got to admit, there's not a whole lot of guidelines there. Yes, you can buy candy and you can buy soda and all that stuff. Those are groceries too. But, I mean, come on. Government's not there to tell you how to shop. They can advise you how to shop. They can educate you how to shop. They can say, you know, that thing you're carrying over your belt there, not really good for you. You're going to die. But on the other hand, all we can do is tell people what you should look like, what you should eat like, what you should exercise like, what you should not do too much of to yourself or in yourself so that you'll have a long, pain-free and healthy life. That's not government's place to legislate that. But when somebody loses their job and you have two or three kids at home, it's not the kid's fault that the dad lost his job. So the dad should be able, or the mom should be able, to go down to the food stamp office at the USDA extension, and they should be able to get some food. And that is what it's there for. But when you have people going to multiple jurisdictions and loading up on groceries, then going down to Main Street and selling it for, or Third Street, I'm sorry, not Main Street, Third Street, selling it for cash and then going out and buying drugs and alcohol while their kids starve at home, that's wrong. And when you have people that sneak across our border, invade our country, and then can, with false ID or now no ID, and now a couple of states, go get food, that's wrong. That's just wrong. And if you have an opinion on it, I'd be happy to discuss it with you. 888-429-5471. Anywhere on planet or off planet, you can reach us at 530-413-4511. Let's talk about it. Because what we have here is a program that has worked very, very well since the Carter days to feed tens of millions of kids that have gone to school, got educations, got jobs, and have paid those food stamps back 1,000 times over, just like I did. But now we have a political system that in its acts of desperation are reaching into the public coffer to make it easy for these individuals to vote in our system, to influence politics. They're buying votes from the wrong group of people. Involved in this financial windfall are nearly $65 billion, with a B, distributed annually to food stamp recipients by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The number has skyrocketed in the last few years from $28.5 billion in 2005 to $64.7 billion in 2010. In part because President Barack Obama has spent millions of dollars to recruit more participants and reduce the stigma associated with food stamps, even as the number surged without taxpayer-funded publicity campaigns, say officials with Judicial Watch, an organization that has a number of lawsuits pending in the federal courts against the Obama administration. This is Mike Baker. He's a political strategist. He says, in my opinion, the whole idea to take advantage of the terrible economy and get more people hooked on programs such as food stamps, Section 8 housing, Medicaid, and other so-called entitlements, once hooked, Obama and the Democrats can always count on their votes. I've often said on this program, those individuals that take advantage of those programs are professional voters. They're paid money to vote. Just like the whiskey drinkers in the early 1900s, just like those that responded to Chicago-style politics of the past, bribery works. Obama's agricultural secretary, Tom Vilsack, claims that increasing the number of food stamp recipients actually helps the economy, strengthens communities, and creates jobs. I'm at a loss here. I must have read that wrong. Let me go back and read this again. Obama's agriculture secretary, Tom Vilsack, claims that increasing the number of food stamp recipients actually helps the economy, strengthens communities, and creates jobs. Okay, I'm done. I don't understand that at all. If you know, what motivates a person to go back and get a job? What motivates a person most to go find work? Hunger. Hunger does. You get hungry, you know? Everybody needs to eat. And when you're on a food stamp program, you need to be in a job training program. It isn't a long-term way of life. I was in college. I was going to school. I had four small kids at home. Of course the food stamp program helped us. But increasing the number of food stamp recipients does not help the economy. It weakens communities by robbing the community members of their dignity. And it doesn't create jobs because those people aren't going out going to work, unless you're talking about farm jobs. The USDA has cited some unknown research that shows every $5 in new food stamp benefits actually generates as much as $9 in economic activity. I'm not getting it. I'm not getting it. I mean, why not put everybody in the whole country on food stamps then if you're getting a 9-to-5 return on your investment? I have to get, let me, I get my calculator out here. Hold on. This is absolutely blowing my mind here. Hang on one second. I'm at a loss. All right, here we go. 5 divided by 8. That's a 55% return on your investment. 45% return on your, 44.5% return on your investment. Guys, there's not a better investment out there. Let's buy food stamps. Come on, it's a 9-to-5 return on your investment. The USDA has cited some unknown research that shows every $5 in new food stamp benefits actually generates as much as $9 in economic activity. I'm not getting it. I don't get it. The tax money that it took to create the fund depletes from the public's ability to borrow money, which actually reduces small business access to funds, which actually makes those small businesses, A, either go out of business, B, fire people, C, work people more hours instead of hiring someone else in order to make ends meet because they can't borrow the money to put the resources in place, equipment, inventory, advertising, whatever they have to do to expand their business, because the government believes they're getting a 9-to-5 return on their investment in food stamps. I'm sorry. It's time for a change here. I did that in 5 seconds on my iPod calculator. The source of the research has never been revealed by the agency. No kidding. And the law enforcement examiner, Judicial Watch, and other investigators have not discovered where Vilsack got his statistics. I'm a statistician, and that's not statistics. If it is, I don't even think 4 out of 5 dentists would agree to that. Come on. That's not flying. I put it in the X squared formula, and it cranks out as a negative number. Huh. Now, so many people get food stamps in the U.S. that a growing number of businesses, including gas stations, dollar discount stores, and pharmacies, are accepting them, according to the USA Today. Oh, it goes beyond that. Even restaurants, which don't participate in the program, are fighting for a piece of the action, according to federal lobbying records cited in the USA Today story. It's true. It's true. You want to know what restaurant? I'm going to tell you, if they don't mention it here. McDonald's. That's right. McDonald's claims their meals are healthy, and they want to take food stamps because people deserve to eat healthy. Now, I know, you think that might be okay, and I know what you're thinking, but settle down a little bit, because I'm going to tell you. If they allow McDonald's to accept food stamps, then you can't stop O'Charlie's, you can't stop Longhorns, you can't stop Golden Corral, you can't stop the sushi place. They're all going to be taking food stamps. And then what do you got? You got kids that aren't eating. Kids are what the food stamps are for. We don't care if the parents get a little skinny. They're supposed to get skinny. But kids aren't. It's not their fault. You can't get food stamps if you don't have kids. That's the way the system works, unless they've changed the rules in the last 45 minutes. With few exceptions, federal rules prohibit food stamps from being cashed in prepared foods. But the pot has gotten large enough to attract many eateries, especially fast food chains, specifically McDonald's. They're the ones lobbying for it. A handful of states let food stamps purchase prepared meals to accommodate the homeless, elderly, and disabled. But now, perfectly healthy and young people want to use food stamps at restaurants. Why? Because they're too lazy to boil potatoes. They're too lazy to take the hamburger and make a patty and fry the hamburger and eat it at home. No. They got to have the double quarter pounder with cheese and bacon. People, this is outrageous. For instance, California, a state that is close to bankruptcy. Did you know that California, just a few years ago, used to be the 11th largest economy in the world by itself? That's right. California, by itself, just as a state, used to be the 11th largest economy in the world. Well, it has a special restaurant meals program that lets food stamps buy prepared foods. Ironically, virtually all of the participating eateries sell the sort of unhealthy cuisine that Michelle Obama has declared war against. She shakes her fist in the air just over her $42,000 diamond bracelets. Don't eat that food. The First Lady believes that fast food chains are largely to blame for an obesity epidemic in America's inner cities. No, it's largely because schools have eliminated activity during recess. That's right. Schools do not allow students to play baseball anymore during recess. No football, no basketball, no skateboarding, no rollerblading, no frisbee throwing, no ball catching. Why? Because it's dangerous. They've taken all the jungle gym equipment off of the playgrounds because of the liability. They've taken the swing sets down, the teeter-totters down, the climbing bars down, the chin-up bars. They've taken all that down because it's dangerous. That's why kids are fat, because they're not allowed to exercise at school anymore. In an interesting twist, Michelle Obama's $4.5 billion measure to revolutionize the inner city diet by countering fast food eateries is being carried out by the USDA. Under the First Lady's brilliant plan, taxpayers are providing fresh produce and grilled lean meats as alternatives to greasy fried foods that tend to be more popular in so-called food deserts infested with fast food chains. Well, that just shows you how the wealthy attack the problem. It isn't about that. I don't think that a secretary of the USDA or the secretary of agriculture should be chosen unless they've been on food stamps. They need to know what that's like. They need to know what that's like to walk into a grocery store with a book of food stamps or a card and swipe that card for food and then walk outside and get in their Cadillac and drive home. They need to know what that feels like. They need to have complete empathy with that. And that's just my opinion. If you have one, you can reach me at 888-429-5471. You ever been on food stamps? Give me a call. You think that food stamps should be able to be used at McDonald's? Give me a call. You think that the administration is buying votes with food stamps? Give me a call. You think that the food stamp program should be changed, done away with, altered? Give me a call. I think it can't be corrupted too badly because it's just food. It isn't money, it's food. There's not much you can do with it. You can't even take the card to another state. You don't see food stamp cards being cashed at cruise lines down in Florida like you do unemployment checks. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's the number two place to cash unemployment checks is cruise lines in Florida. Bet you didn't know that. The number one, casinos. That's right. Unemployment checks cashed at casinos is the number one. The rest of them are put in the bank and people use them normally, but cashing checks, that's where you find it. Cruise lines, casinos, just to give you an idea how really hurting people are. So, America is ready for a phase change, hence the science to this theory. It's hard to tell if the idea that Ron Paul cannot win in 2012 is more ignorant in its complete lack of historical sophistication or more arrogant in its claim to certainty amid all the complexity of 300 million lives and the myriad issues that affect them here in the United States. Sometimes, perhaps once every few generations, a nation can undergo what a mathematician or a physicist would call a phase change. And that's what I'm talking about here tonight, a phase change. The classic example of such a thing is a statistical pile of sand. you can take a grain at a time and you can add it to the pile, 1, then 2, then 10, then 20, then, you know, and so forth. And the pile will continue to grow higher and higher. And then, for a statistically unpredictable reason, one grain can be added to the pile of sand and you get an avalanche. And the sand goes sliding down the sides and the base of the pile gets wider and the peak drops. We don't really know when it's going to happen, but we know it's repeatable and we know that it happens. Every complex system does this, including nations. And it should be obvious, more obvious than a pile of sand. The important point for those who would presume to make such grand predictions as Dr. Paul cannot win is that no examination of the pile of sand, for instance, can tell you when it will actually happen. But happen it does. Indeed, happen it must. And that is the science of it. I'm going to get into a little more detail, but Alex is back on the phone. We rarely get Alex actually on the phone. Usually he texts, so I'm going to go ahead and let him come on again. Alex, welcome back.
Hey, Brooks, this is Alex again. It's just, it was such an interesting topic right now that I thought I'd call back in. You know what's really interesting was, I don't know if I can do this on air or not, but, you know, today during conference, or actually it was last night during the priesthood session of General Conference for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, they told about how welfare really should be run. In Arizona, there was a dry wash that basically flooded and flooded several farmers out. And a state president, Kimball, sent in for some church welfare. Well, for money, instead of getting the money, he got 3 general authorities to come down and help them manage their resources to get things done.
That's the way it should be done. Yeah, I totally agree with that. The way, you know, I was listening to one of the programs this morning, and one of the stockbrokers was actually arguing, what do we need FEMA for anyway? Why do we need a Federal Emergency Management Administration? Why can't that be handled by the
exactly.
state in which that actually occurs? Why can't the money just be given to the state and the state can administer it? Why do you need the federal government to apply billions of dollars to something they're not attached to? And so how did it turn out for these farmers that were washed out by this flood?
Right. Anyway, as the point that they were making is welfare should never it should be there only as any type of charity should not be an end-all and be-all. It should be there to, it's hanging on the tip of my tongue, but I'm not.
That's okay. Let me see if I can help you out a little bit. It's meant to be a hand up, not a hand out. And, you know, when people are asked at Christmas or Easter or whenever, what gives you the better feeling, giving to someone else or receiving? 90% of the people will say giving. I love to give to other people. I love the way it makes me feel. Well, if that's the case, you know, the 90% of the people that actually received the stuff didn't feel as good as the people that were giving. And unfortunately, we have grown a section of our society that now enjoys receiving. They don't like giving at all. They just want to take.
Right.
And so the nation is ready for this phase change, like the sand piled high. Some call it a revolution. I'm going to call it a phase change because it's much more scientific sounding. But we're ready to realize that the way the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has administered welfare for 200 years is the right way to do it. I saw after the tornado hit Louisville many years ago, there was a newscast, and they were, this is before the Red Cross even came in. The church was on site immediately, setting up tables, helping people with first aid, water, ice, things like that. And the news person was on the radio and said, well, before the Red Cross even got here, there were two groups that showed up that really know what they're doing. One is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and the other one is the Mormons.
Yep, that's right, that's right. I remember that. Yep.
So, they have the right way to do it. You know, if you go to the church and you ask them for money to pay a light bill, they're probably going to ask you to mow the lawn or rake leaves or go mow the lawn of a widow's house or empty her trash or fix her garage door or something. Why? Not because, you know, they want to make you do something. Are you crazy? That's not it at all.
Mm-hmm.
If you receive something for nothing, it robs you of your dignity.
Anyway, another thing is, as far as using tax money to do charities, the thing is, taxes are taken away from everyone can't run for office if you don't pay taxes. You can't, you're severely hampered as far as your citizenship is concerned if you don't pay taxes. So if it's utilized for charities or to take care of the poor, I think you ought to be able to opt in for taking care of the poor, don't you?
Yeah, I think so. But what we have is we have a generation of people who are professional voters. They're professional takers. They get fat,
right,
and lazy.
Right.
They haven't worked a hard day in their entire lives, and they have been given everything. A perfect example is to look what's happened to certain communities in our nation. They have 70% of their children are born out of wedlock. They have no breadwinner at home because the government is the breadwinner. Who needs a man at home when the government will provide
right.
you everything you need? You just don't. And we've seen a complete sociological breakdown, a disintegration of the family unit because of that.
You know, right about this time, and a great way to end the call is, the change in society is basically to the point that everyone's saying, I'm mad as, beep, and I won't take it anymore.
Well, you're exactly right. But I don't want people to be mad as you know what. I want them to love as you know what. I want them to love the nation. I want them to love the planet. I want them to love themselves. And I want them to love this process because hatred is never going to develop anything that's positive or beneficial for society. But this phase change, and by the way, Alex, I really appreciate the call. I know how difficult it is to call in. I really appreciate your texts. I hope that you keep listening and keep sending to me and keep listening to X-Squared Radio. Thanks so much, Alex.
No problem. Have a good day. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye. What we want to see is we want to see this phase change happen, because it will happen and it must happen. And there are numerous examples of abrupt and drastic phase changes in the politics of great nations. Here's a perfect example. I read this book called The Last Lion, and such an incredible literary work about Winston Churchill. The UK, the country from which we came, and where my family comes from, not Britain, but Scotland, provides a compelling and closely relevant example. As every schoolboy knows, Churchill led Britain to victory in the Second World War. Indeed, he did as much as any man on earth ever has to save civilization as we know it. He is the man that saved the world. It was not the American president that had the stiff upper lip. It wasn't America that was being bombed every night and infiltrated during the day. Britain fought the war years longer than the United States did. And they did so under tremendous pressure. 3 months after the entire nation poured into the streets to cheer this great leader, the man a few years ago voted by Britons the greatest Briton of all time, Churchill went to the country in a general election to retain his position as prime minister. There was simply no way he could lose. The best slogan the Labour Party, his opposition, could come up with was, "Cheer Churchill, vote Labour." That's as nasty as they would get. And amazingly, that is exactly what the nation did. Churchill was defeated. No one anywhere, including the people of Britain who voted in the election, had even thought about the possibility. No newspaper had considered it. After all, the election was a foregone conclusion in Churchill's favor, and yet an unseen, perhaps unconscious will of the people caused a cultural and political phase change in the British nation, as they neither knew they wanted nor knew they had the power to cause. Many historians now say that the unseen sentiment that produced this result that shocked not just the British, but the whole world, was the idea that all the blood and treasure lost to maintain the freedom of the British Empire and the Western world demanded something more than continuation of the old political settlement. After a huge crisis, the people wanted a whole new system. In 1945, the Labour Party, with its vision of state-delivered, cradle-to-grave security of health and basic material well-being, in some way met that national desire for a grand political change. And now Britain is buried in that. Greece has undergone riots. London has undergone riots. The United States right now on the Boston Bridge and on Wall Street is undergoing riots for the same thing. One has to reach back a good way in American history for a time of such rapidly rising sentiment that not only are our leaders unable to even think of real solutions to the problems of greatest concern, rather than just making expedient changes at the margin, but also that the prevailing political and economic system is structurally incapable of delivering any long-term solutions in its current form. The sheer range of interconnectedness of the problems that the American nation faces are such that any permanent solution to any one of them will require profound systemic change that will necessarily upset many economic, political, and cultural equilibria. That is nothing more than a definition of a national phase change. The average American may not know what is to be done, but he or she can sense when the system has exhausted all its possibilities. You feel it. I feel it. At this point, not only does the phase change become reasonable, it becomes desirable. Even if what lies on the other side cannot be known. As anyone can find out just by talking to a broad cross-section of Ron Paul's supporters, his base is not uniform in its agreement on the standard issues of typical American party political conflict. In fact, Paul's supporters vary significantly, even in their views of what is the old left-right paradigm and what are the wedge issues. Rather, they are united around concepts that could almost be called metapolitical. Metapolitical, above political. Whether left or right really exists, and if they do, whether they are really opposed. Whether centralized government should even be the main vehicle for political change. And whether there are some principles that should be held sacrosanct for long-term benefit, even if they will hurt us in the short run. In other words, ending the unemployment checks. In other words, ending food stamp benefits for those that do not deserve them. Putting people into training programs that are receiving government benefits. For those with eyes to see, such realignments and reprioritization may even be glimpses of America after its next phase change. If Ron Paul has committed support from 10% of the adult population, and most of that 10% support him precisely because they believe he represents a whole new political system. And he does. An entirely new political settlement. Then we may be close to critical mass. Just a few grains of sand short of the avalanche. We have 10 months and a couple days before this election period gets to the point where you could really make this happen. Another piece of evidence that the nation is close to a phase change and a gestalt switch is the very fact that the prevailing paradigm from which the mainstream media, established political class, etc. operate has to ignore huge amounts of data about Ron Paul and the movement around him to continue to make any sense. You see that every day. The press talks about the top three. The press talks about the incredible rise of Herman Cain, but they do not mention Ron Paul. The studied neglect of data as irrelevant is invariably indicative that the neglected data are hugely important. If information doesn't really matter, why go to all the effort at ignoring it? First and most directly, he does extremely well in polls. The organization of his grassroots support is not just excellent, it's remarkable. By historic and global measures, his ability to raise money from actual voters is second to none. He raised three times as much for military personnel as all the other candidates combined. He even raised more than Obama. His appeal to independents and swing voters is an order of magnitude greater than that of his competitors. Secondarily, he has more support from military personnel than all the other candidates put together, measured by donations. He has the most consistent voting record. He has the magical quality of not coming off as a politician. And he oozes integrity and authenticity. And as far as we know, he has a personal life and marriage that reflects deep stability and commitment. To believe that Ron Paul's victory is a long shot, in spite of all standard indicators that directly contradicts this claim, is to throw out all the norms and all the data and all the statistics which we follow with our nation's politics. And that is a huge thing to do. The only way it can honestly be done is to present another set of contradictory reasons or metrics that are collectively more powerful than all those that you are rejecting And I got to tell you, folks, I read them all, and I have yet to find them. If it's true that the studied neglect of data to hold tight to a paradigm is the best evidence that the paradigm is about to collapse, then the massive and highly subjective neglect of all things Paulian is specific evidence that the country is about to move in Paul's direction. Of course, none of this means that Paul will definitely win, but it does mean that a bet against him by a politician is foolhardy. It is worth returning to Churchill's career for an even more delicious example. Just days before he became the great wartime leader, his career had been written off as that of a kook, and he was being discussed as someone who had extreme ideas and whose thinking did not reflect the mood of the nation. The House of Commons was abuzz with his decline and imminent fall. And then, rather suddenly, something he had been saying for many years, that there was something rotten in the state of Germany, became so obvious that it could no longer be avoided. Once the nation saw that he had been right all along, he became the leader of the free world in very short order. His career changed. Britain changed. The world changed. No one had seen that coming, either. In fact, everyone thought they knew what was coming. The kook was about to disappear into the political backwaters, if not the political wilderness. Do I need to draw the parallel? I don't think so. We're just about out of time. If Paul wins, it won't be because he's the kind of candidate Americans have always gone for. Far from it. It will be precisely because Americans have collectively decided on a dramatically new way of doing business, a new political and economic paradigm. And then, he'll not only have ceased to be a long shot, he'll be the only shot. We'll see you next week, right here on X Squared Radio. Thank you so much.
It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.